And good evening from New Antarctica, here in Greene County, New York. It's been a snowy few days, and I am up to your audio reading for Gemini Rising, and maybe there's a few Gemini Moon people. Moon does real good in Gemini, by the way. So, hidey-ho, and I'm looking at your chart here and kind of trying to figure out where to start. The thing about your astrology, the way all the new planetary placements shake out in the Gemini chart is quite excellent. Even though it's the same planets going into the same signs, how you turn that chart around makes a big difference. And when you turn the chart to using Gemini as the first place, it's very cool. And it puts the resources in the right places, right? The planetary placements are resources. They also can represent opportunity. That's a resource. They can represent challenges. That can be a resource. They can represent assets, talents, and generally change. And there's a lot of change happening right now. We can see that just by looking out at the world, and we can see it when you look at the chart and you see how much is different from the past couple of years. And one of the big differences is perhaps it's right up there. It's hard to rank these things, and we'll be able to see a little more clearly once all this complete madness settles down in Aries, which, by the way, if you're in the United States, you're seeing it with this big, big drama in Minneapolis, completely unnecessary. That's being driven by all this Aries, you know, Marshall, you know, Marsy type of stuff. And then we've got Pluto newly in Aquarius, and even as I speak right now, Mars is making that conjunction to Pluto. It's a hot day. It's a for 10 degrees Fahrenheit. It's a hot day. So the thing is, with this astrology, we're seeing the effects of it in the collective, and it affects us as individuals. So the nature of this discussion is, I'm just going to basically do my best to explain what your solar chart is about in a way that I did not explain in the written. I don't even look back. I just look at the chart and I start over again. And it's been a few months since I wrote the Gemini essay. But the one thing the readings will have in common is the lead story for Gemini is Uranus coming to your sign for 7 years. And kind of as a second paragraph of that lead story, Uranus coming to Gemini for 7 years, is Sedna is already there. And Sedna is a whole other kind of animal. I'm happy that astrology, you know, at least admits it exists, but it wasn't long ago that the longest planet had a 29-year orbit. That would be Saturn. But before Uranus was discovered, then was a 84-year orbit, and then a 164-year orbit. Neptune, Pluto, 248-year orbit. Those are very, compared to Sedna, quite short. Sedna's, we know Pluto is slow, right? But Sedna is so slow that Pluto can go around the sun approximately 44 times, maybe 45 times Pluto, which takes 248 years for Sedna to go around once. So this has never happened, along with the long list of things that have never happened, along with other things that have never happened. We've never had, nobody remembers Pluto and Aquarius. At least we have historical records of Pluto and Aquarius. But historical records of Sedna, we're talking about glaciers. We're at the Sedna return of the glaciers. And so this is with you. And there's this odd interplay, between Uranus and Sedna, which to me seems like a figure ground kind of a thing. Meaning that the background energy field, the ground field, it's the ground, it's the dirt out of which the plants and flowers grow, is the Sedna level. And the figure level is Uranus. And they work together. Uranus is the obvious thing, the obvious breakthrough, the invention, the inventor, the development, the thing obviously changing, and the obvious agent of change. That's Uranian. But Sedna is practically invisible. I mean, it still blows my mind that we're using a planet with an 11,400-year orbit. And there are some with a bigger orbit, but they're not... I'm unlikely to use them because I set limits. But Sedna is... if you're vaguely sensitive to minor planets, Sedna is unmissable. And the astrology community did a good job delineating Sedna, I think. And of course, Mike Brown and company did a good job naming Sedna after an Inuit goddess. And if you're the type who likes mythology, I would strongly encourage you to not bring in the elements of the myth of Sedna and try to apply them directly to Sedna, the planetary placement. I think we've got to go much, much larger with Sedna. And look at factors that drive the entire environment. Like the entire digital environment, for example, would be a Sedna factor. The impact of the digital environment, Eris factor, on individuals. So in a private sense, in the sense of who you are inwardly, Sedna represents your sensitivity to the entire digital environment. Now, I'm the only fool talking about this, and I know I'm risking losing people because it's not so stupid. it's not stupid, right? It's like, oh, this is a real thing. So there is an environment. The environment's driving everything. And if you want to know why this madness is going on, pick a place. It's going on because of digital. And the digital is, it's a fantasy world, and people don't think that it's real, and it's eviscerated their conscience, and they therefore don't have a sense of participation. Okay, so Sedna describes that whole environment as an external, but as an internal, it's where you tune in. And the where you tune in and get actual information about the environment that you are in. And the reason this is so important is because you have Uranus about to arrive. It'll make a conjunction to Sedna. And this comes in with a big sis boom ba. This is not some kind of like, you know, yawner transit. Uranus is special. I mean, look up a picture of it and say, wow, that's kind of me these days. Beautiful green thing with rings and several natural satellites. And it's on a really weird angle. And it's just a beautiful cosmic creature. And when what it represents is, in as few words as you can make it, it represents technological progress. It emerged at the time of the development of electrical technology, so it really is one of the most important sigils of the electrical age. But generally, it represents inventors. By the way, if you can swing it, there's a fabulous little book by Richard Tarnas, the author of Cosmos and Psyche, that is all about Uranus, how it was misnamed, and what it really does, what it really is about. And the book is called Prometheus, The Awakener. And what Rick said is, Uranus has much more in common with a general framework of Prometheus, i.e. stealing fire from the gods and bringing it to humanity. Well, that sounds like technology. The fire of the gods? What the hell's that? It's a computing power, electricity. What is that? Well, yeah, it's those things. And then it emerges in the 1780s at the time of, well, it's contemporaneous with the U.S. Constitution, and it's contemporaneous with the rise of electricity. Just a century later, the world was pretty much wired with power plants and electricity. But it also acts as an accelerant to anything, and it is forward thinking. That's what Prometheus means. It's facing forward, and it is a disruptor. And so, why I think, just me personally, that this two-part transit entering, now in the process of entering Gemini, is so crucial to work with both the Sedna aspect and the Uranus aspect. Because the Sedna aspect grants or describes environmental sensitivity. And the Uranus factor, the Prometheus factor, kind of sort of couldn't give a shit about the environment. It's like, just going to do what it's going to do. That's it. Let's have an experiment. Oh, we got shocked. All right, let's have another experiment. And there is this bold spirit of Uranus. I mean, in a way, it is a potentially helpful thing that there is something described in astrology that accounts for the human experience of progress without any respect for the consequences. That's Uranus. No concern about the consequences. I'm not saying that in itself is a good thing. I am saying that it is very important that we have something that describes progress without respect for the consequences, because it's a real thing. And Sedna, in this case, can represent two different things, one of which is the background field where this is all happening. And further, it can represent the way in which the ground creates the figure. In a sense, a tree grows out of the ground. Everyone looks at the tree. Maybe you see some roots going into the ground. You probably don't think about it. You're thinking about the apples, or you're thinking about climbing it, or you're thinking about the shade. But generally, in the figure ground discussion of the tree and the ground it's growing out of, the tree gets the attention, and the ground produced the tree. So Sedna represents all of those things that produce the technological breakthrough, and in the case of Uranus, the obsession with movement. Now, these things with like forward, quote-unquote, progress, these things are unlikely to be thematically part of your life in the way that I'm describing them. But the idea of things moving very quickly is definitely something that's going to influence you. Because under the influence of Uranus, particularly in Gemini, progress is very rapid. And the truth is, you may be more the earthy type of Taurus who's not interested in progress. You would like things to kind of stay the same for a while. And so, let's see what you would do if you wanted things to sort of stay the same for a while. Well, you might become a very astute observer. You might really work the Sedna end of that polarity and really focus on the ground field. Now, in Gemini, the ground field is human. And so the sensitivity bestowed by Sedna of the human ground field is how the people around you think and feel and how they're affected by existence the way that it is now. So you are bestowed with a diversity of things owing to the Uranus-Sedna conjunction in your sign. And they include a kind of drive. I mean, you could be, if you want to be, a serious driver of change. Change can be disruptive. And that this is the way the tech world works. All the people who are developing quote-unquote innovations, have you noticed this? They strive to disrupt. And so we are in one disruption after the next. Nothing really catches on. Everything is just kind of dumped on us. There are other ways to invent. There are other ways to innovate. It does not have to be like lightning strikes the tower every 5 minutes. However, people with a strong first house Uranus, which you're going to have for a while, tend to be intricate and deep thinkers. They're willing to think beyond what the current thinking of our time is. They are often a little bit erratic, as in unpredictable. And they're generally quite brilliant. Two that come to mind are, I've shared recently a Gene Shepard audio, The Great Indiana Blizzard. I don't know if you saw that today. The Great Indiana Blizzard with a Gene Shepard show from January 1964. Uranus Rising. And Marshall McLuhan. So what I'm getting at here is that Uranus in the first house can impart a kind of brilliance. And it may come on fast and furious. And what I'm suggesting is that even if you're feeling this, whether you're feeling it in the form of actual ideas, whether you're feeling it in the form of acceleration, whether you're feeling it in the form of wanting to be unusually, let's say, randy, focus on the Sedna aspect. You can't go wrong tapping in to the environmental level. By the environmental level, I mean all the information that's coming to you, all the sensory data, all of the facts of the world that are generally treated as if they are invisible. They largely are. So what I'm saying is that, you know, Uranus is the lightning bolt that strikes. Uranus is the specific idea. Uranus is the sense of motivation. But the rest of the story, in fact, almost all of the story, is told by whatever it is that Sedna represents. And this sensitivity is extremely important because the environment is so freaking chaotic and overwhelming, and there is no what do we say here? There's no escaping this. But what you can do is you can drop in a little bit deeper and see if you can tune into the force in nature that is driving everything and feel the environment in which this is happening. I feel like I'm not making my point well enough here, but I will end this part of the discussion by saying that in the world we're overwhelmed by figure and we pay almost no attention to ground. And ground is a lot of things, but mostly they can't be seen in the way that you can see, you know, somebody dancing around on the stage, right? That's clearly a figure. And you may not notice the people, you know, the stagehands and the lighting designers and the choreographer and all that, right? All you see is the person dancing. You see them dancing. Usually you're not thinking choreographer. There's always a choreographer. You're not thinking about the lighting cues. You're not thinking about, is there a doctor in the house, right? You don't need a doctor in the house till you need a doctor in the house. So then the doctor goes from ground, hidden, invisible, to figure, right? Somebody stands up. Has this ever happened? Somebody, collapses on stage, or there's a sick member of the audience. I've got to stop the show. And someone says, is there a doctor in the house? Well, now like 10 people would raise their hand. And then the person who was previously just a guy in a suit or a woman in a suit or something, stands up. Ah, yes, I'm an osteopath, family practitioner. and the allopath's all grown. But, go to the osteopath. All right, so figure and ground. I'm very excited about Sedna in Gemini. While we're on the topic, and let's wrap up the segment, give him a few more different angles, maybe a little more earthy than, all this like figure ground stuff. Uranus can represent a group. One of the things that actually is fairly accurate about Uranus is it can be kind of group oriented in nature. And Gemini is two. It is either dualistic, the self in hemispheres, left hemisphere of the brain, right hemisphere of the brain, or two people, or in various configurations, could be the lovers, the twins, the brothers, various different things. Uranus tends to multiply things. So this indicates that, you might have more group involvement than usual. And finally, there is no way that you're going to go through this experience of Uranus in Gemini, it's going to last 7 years, being meekly sensitive. That you're not gonna be a little weird. You're not gonna want to be a little bit eccentric, and you may find yourself doing things that you don't normally do, or wanting to do things that you don't normally do. You may find yourself acting in ways that are unusual. You may find yourself going places, wanting completely different types of people. And this can go from like eccentric to erratic. You might want to tell your friends you're going through this. And also, you're not a puppet on a string, right? Right. If you are, you're also the puppeteer. So you basically can be as weird as you want to be. But there's a bit of let your freak flag fly with Uranus coming through your first house, and get real good at taking notes. And the idea you wake up with at 3 o'clock in the morning is worth writing down under this astrology. It really is worth writing down, because there's going to be some real strokes of genius coming through you, but you're not going to be advertising yourself as a genius, just a little bit of a weirdo. And what you're going to be doing is being the sensitive, as I've described it before, the old man in this one particular book who jumps off the side of the boat. He's a fisherman. He's very old, and he jumps off the boat, and he blows the air out of his lungs, and he sinks down under the water, and he listens for the fish. Mm-hmm. And then he comes back up. So one of the ways this may express itself is through this total transformation going on inside Aries. And this too is an interesting figure ground contrast. So one of my, I've explained this a million times. I'll probably see if I can round up all the different things I've written about it, make an awesome little book. One of my theories about what makes a sign tick the way that it does is where Aries lands in that sign. So Aries can land a lot of places. For Pisces, it lands in the second place. For Cancer, it lands in the 10th place. For Scorpio, it lands in the 6th place. For Taurus, it lands in the 12th place. For Gemini, it lands in the 11th place. The 11th place is the best house. The best house is house 11. Okay, maybe I'm exaggerating a little, but I'll say it again. It's the best house, and you have Aries there. And the reason it's the best house is it's the house of fulfillment of many things. It's the house of your hopes, dreams, and visions. It is also a very social house. And so the reason why I say this is kind of a Gemini superpower is that you are very social. And one of the reasons why you're very social is you tend to find yourself or look for yourself or like establish a relationship with your growth in social environments. Now, you have an introspective side, and you may not even be an extrovert, but what I'm saying is that you like to be in a room full of people, some of them you know and some of them you don't know. That's the 11th house. But the thing is, everybody knows somebody in a group of the 11th house. It's not like a random sample of people at a football game, though it would be very funny to just, you know, identify totally at random 20 people in a football game and, you know, pay them enough to show up for a meeting or a Zoom call and see if you can find any interrelationship between those 20 people. Do they have any mutual friends and so forth? The 11th is much simpler. The 11th is basically friends and friends of friends. And it is your, it's a primary field, primary ground field for gaining self-understanding. And this is where a lot of the action is right now. A lot of the Mishigas that we're seeing, this whole frickin' business in Minnesota, all of this is the digital effect affecting people's sanity. And one of the gifts that Sedna may bestow is your sensitivity to when someone is a crazy person. When someone is a, it's important to know, not just a weirdo, not just eccentric, but when someone is nuts. And the nuts that we have right now, it's a very sly kind of nuts because it's the kind of nuts of what people do when they don't know who they are. And then they're going to do all these things that make them feel like they knew who they are. It's like a really cheap, stupid form of self-actualization to aggress on people. But it's one of the defining characteristics of the internet is people doing all kinds of weird, douchey things to each other, but not, and they're doing it because they're scooped out, whether it's temporary effect of the environment or whether they don't have the capacity to, shall we say, mind their manners in the digital environment. After all, no one's watching. After all, who cares? It can just be deleted. Who cares? I can just delete you and there's nothing you can do about it. Ha ha. This is the madness of the digital environment. And the problem with it is when it spills over into the actual real world human environment, it usually does so as attitudes and values. And often that can come down to a big whopping case of digititis in the form of complete lack of sensitivity. The assumption that everything is some form of an irrelevant fantasy. This is not really happening. When plainly it is, or someone can con themselves out of it. Domestic terrorists in Minneapolis.
fucking joke. But look, there are people who are like, well, clearly that, you know, school teacher or that like nurse from the Veterans Administration, clearly they're a domestic terrorist. Oh, then if they are, then you are, right? So, but that's one of the ways people do things in the digital environment to completely pretend that, that what is not, and that what is not is what is. And so what Sedna will do, if you're not drowned out by Uranus, is you'll have that sensitivity and you carry that sensitivity wherever you go. And that includes in the social environment, which for you is about Aries. And there are two big events happening in Aries right now. One of the events is, well, today Neptune entered Aries in a week or so. Saturn's going to enter Aries. And then on the 20th or something, there's going to be the conjunction of Saturn and Neptune in Aries in the first place. This is very important for you because Aries for you is already a semi-public environment, or shall we say semi-private environment, because the 11th is exactly right on the line of public and private. And there are stages to getting out of that, so that's why it's friends and friends of friends. There shouldn't be somebody it's very rare, unless someone crashes the party, that there's anyone at the party that no one at the party knows. That's the 11th house. As soon as there's people there who no one knows and no one has heard of, that's the public entering this 11th house type of space. But what the conjunction of Saturn and Neptune on the Aries point does is it kind of removes the door between public and private. And that's pretty big. That's pretty important. Because it's going to invite an incursion into that space. Now, it could mean that you meet a lot of people. It could be that your whole experience of the social environment is going to become a more celebrity type of experience of the where you just meeting a lot of people that you've never met before. That's very likely to happen. But you have filters. The good thing is you've got filters. You've got the filter of Neptune and the filter of Saturn, and you've got them working together, which is a multiplier effect, not an additive effect. So you have this very unusual superpower, and apart from a brief spell over the summer of 25, Northern Hemisphere, where there was a near miss, this has never happened before. It just hasn't happened before. Saturn, Neptune, and the Aries point. So we don't know where this is going to go. We don't know. There's going to be an effect that we've never seen before. And that effect is going to show up first and foremost in your social world. That's why these sensitivities of Uranus and Neptune are so important. And what this will do is give you social freedom to experiment with being a different person. It's nice to have that social freedom. The 11th house can be confining and conformist and can have a sense, well, if I do something wrong, I'm going to get rejected by this kind of quasi-tribe. But you're going to have more freedom. And this is going to happen a second way, because there is a similar effect coming out of the conjunction of Eris and Chiron, which is, for you, I think, will be facilitating of a bold and very interesting to experience kind of radical individuality in the context of all the people you already know. This is why I'm saying your whole chart hangs together like a fucking tailored suit. It's just fantastic. Because, so for example, that Chiron Eris in Aries, which gives you permission to not be a digital android and therefore be yourself, will be very nicely aided and abetted by the Uranus Sedna conjunction in the first place, right? That's also very individualistic, very self-expressive. And it is where the individual meets the group, another theme that shows up over and over again. So the thing to do with all of this is to have fun with it.
The one thing about the digital age is it has made people so damn serious that you can barely get them talking to each other, much less laughing at something. And what I suspect is that the effect for you is going to be one of quite a bit of gregariousness. I mean, you're already a conversant person. You're not afraid of people. You'll walk up to anyone and talk to them. But this is like nothing you've ever seen or felt before. This is quite exciting and quite cool. So get ready to completely be yourself in this new and wholly unrestrained way. Great fun. What else is going on here? All right, so covered that. Covered house 1. Covered house 11. We've covered, I'm not sure I'm ready to talk about Chiron yet. Let's talk about Pluto in Aquarius. This is now, it's not getting old, but it's being treated kind of like, oh, all right, that was so 2024. And the ingress transit of Pluto into Aquarius out of Capricorn was very much a creature of 23 and 24. ChatGPT comes out and kind of starts to mess with everything in late 22. Amazing it's been that long. Right during the last gasp of Pluto in Capricorn, this shit happens. The biggest factors inducing change can happen at the very end of an outer planet transit through a sign. And this happened. And my whole theory of Pluto in Aquarius is a spiritual theory that this is one of many transits describing the digital effect. And just to recount them, that is Uranus, Sedna in Gemini, all the business in Aries, and Pluto in Aquarius. And not only do they describe the spiritual crisis of the digital effect, they all describe a sense of where the one meets the many. You don't have to stretch this, right? You don't have to study the moons of Uranus. Maybe you get a little clue. No, this is like all plainly obvious. Now, we saw a pre-Pluto and Aquarius eruption of the Aquarius spiritual crisis during the 2020 crisis. I call it the 2021 crisis, 2020 plus, because I refuse to use the word pandemic seriously when what was all going on was basically driven by computer algorithms and people acting like robots, including nurses and doctors and the government. And it was all a bunch of robotics that in fact hurt people. But it wasn't that there was a germ going around. It was that there was a concept going around and a whole level of things way, 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 way behind the scenes involving banking. And this is also going on late in the Pluto and Capricorn game. Pluto and Capricorn was all about banking. Now we've got Pluto in Aquarius, which is your ninth place. I'm describing the entire Pluto and Aquarius crisis itself as an inherently spiritual crisis. But you have it in the ninth place. The ninth is the house of spiritual. The church, the priesthood, one's cosmic beliefs, one's religion, one's relationship to the cosmos, all forms of long-distance travel, going far away places like all the way to the Great Attractor, you know, all the way to the Galactic Center, and also things like the higher courts. Their higher courts are in a different house than the regular court. Local courts, 7th house. Higher courts, 9th house. Okay. Institutions like the United Nations, 9th house. Publishing, 9th house. travel. I probably implied that. So when Pluto enters a sign and a house, which it always does together, this is creating of a very strong focus on that house and all the topics associated with that house in the style described by the sign. So the ninth is usually very far-reaching and tends to have an open feeling and open-minded. It's very Sagittarian. But Aquarius tends to have a bit of an elitist feeling. It can be conformist. It can be representative of set established patterns. And Pluto is going to shake all of that up big time. It is already doing so. It's bending your worldview around itself. The key is to observe when you are in obsessive mode. Pluto can operate invisibly. When Pluto's operating, one of the things it can do is it can operate invisibly as obsession. So the indicator that Pluto is going to be active for you is going to be, for example, some type of a spiritual obsession, a big right and wrong drama, like a big kind of overblown sense of right and wrong, and then various forms of social pressure applied to you, whether or not you go for it or whether or not you resist, are very important questions. So what I was getting at was during the 2020-2021 crisis, which I refuse to call a pandemic, there was a lot of Aquarius. And what this showed was the ease with which people can be crushed into accepting a point of view that is actually not their own and taking actions that violate their values, violate their point of view, and that they actually don't want to do, but they know they're succumbing to peer pressure in order to do it. And there's a lot of human psychological experiments that indicate that people can really be pressured, crushed into doing things that have nothing to do with who they are or what they feel or what their faith leads them to be doing or what they actually honestly believe. They can get crushed. And we saw this happen in 2020-21 plus over and over and over again. And like, if you did something that you regret, you've got to break that down and analyze why and be grateful you survived. And then also figure out what that weakness in you was that you didn't stand up to the people that you needed to stand up to and tell them to fuck off. Pretty simple. Some very strong people they knuckled under. They did. And here it becomes very important because it's no longer just something like Jupiter or Saturn in Aquarius. Now we're talking Pluto. And this is, high stakes. It's going to matter a lot more this time. And with Sedna, you're on notice to pay attention to what's going on in the world around you. However you choose to define that term, world around you. And I would say with Pluto in the ninth house, the bigger the better. The world is the world. All right. Back in a bit. part of what's going on and driving all of this complete wilderness in the world is the disembodying effect of digital technology in particular and electrical technology generally. Now, I know it may seem like a little late in the game to be whining about electricity and, you know, what, you know, will email affect our children? But, right, even that, like, oh, now there's a campaign against social media, right? Oh, well, we were only 30 years late on that one, or, okay, 2009 or whatever the heck it was, Instagram. No, I'm talking about the effects of something that was, you know, the big rollout was around 1890 in the cities. The house I'm sitting in was probably lit by oil lamps until like 1920. So that's the environmental factor that your little Sedna Spidey sense is going to tell you something about, which is that the madness is being driven by the digital environment. And the madness of the digital environment is a lack of contact with self. It is disembodying, but doing a lot of yoga does not necessarily help this. I'm not sure why. And you might say, well, yoga makes me a sane person. Also, look, maybe it helps. But you have to not take for granted that, for example, yoga does. Because the effect of the digital environment is so subtle and pernicious until we see it erupting in complete madness without the appropriate pushback. You see, to me, that's the digital effect. That's that a government or branches of a government might do completely, utterly outrageous things, part one, and part two, people are like, yeah, and, oh, we always knew they were this way. That's the problem. You can expect violent, stupid douchebags to be violent, stupid douchebags. But what we're counting on is that people care. So the question is, do people care, and are they able to express an individual conscience? See, this is the issue with yoga. Yoga has nothing to do in any way with individual conscience. So that's why it does not help. The kind of, and maybe embodiment's the wrong word, but that's currently the best word. By that I mean the embodiment of inner conscience, which is a sense of right and wrong. It should be listed as an inner sense. Conscience is a very, very important inner sense. And what all these technologies do is they just blow the inner senses out. They completely rearrange them. Let's consider what's going on in the eighth place. Capricorn, for you. Pluto's just been through the territory. The first thing, if I didn't already say so, I kind of gave this writing assignment to everyone, was like, make a list of all the important things that happened between 2008 and 2024. Now, that's a long time, right? And the fact that it's a long time is important, 16 years. But I really mean things associated with the topics of the eighth house, major relationship changes, anything involving a will, a trust, or a legacy, anything inheritance like that, anything involving the affairs of your in-laws, and anything really unusual involving sex, which can include getting married. And if you became an OnlyFans girl, I would add that to the list, because it ticks off two of the important boxes of the eighth house, sex and money. I'm guessing you probably didn't become an OnlyFans girl, but if you did, please send me your page so I can just get a look at how incredible your artwork is. But no, we're probably talking wills, estates, trust, legacies, marriages, and divorces in the eighth place. What happened between 2008 and 2024? What's that trajectory? What's that timeline? It should not be a timeline with 30 items. You should limit your timeline to like 8 items. eighth house, eight items. You may think of other ones. What did you learn from all that? What about you actually transformed, grew, evolved, and changed? In a number of different houses that I've been reading, I've been talking about the relationship of the one and the many, the group and the individual, the ways in which groups and individuals can attempt to act on one another. And of course, why the 2020 plus crisis was so important is we got this big demonstration of how groups can impact individuals and essentially erase individuality and it's very tribal. You can't be the only individuals in a tribe are like the medicine man, the chief, chief's daughter, and maybe like the lead hunter. Besides that, tribes are made of people who do not have individual identity. And this whole digital frontier that we're on is a frontier of depleted individual identity and depleted interior conscience. This is such an important factor of the ninth. And in the eighth, what I'm beating around the bush here, it is getting a little bit late and I'm not totally focused as I should be in terms of every sentence making sense, but not that they ever do, is family pressure taking over for conscience. This is the thing you got to watch. And it's not just family pressure. Well, we think you should live in New Haven and not in Fairfield, whatever. No, this is people who have no effing business telling you what to do. And frankly, no effing business giving anyone advice because they've got so many problems of their own and or playing games with various things involving matters of the eighth house, death, dowry, and the substance of the bride. Just extrapolate. You'll see that it goes a lot of places. Sex, death, money, power, jealousy, secrets, control, surrender, sex in the context of marriage, all that is bought and sold with marriage. Well, all of those things can put a lot of pressure on a person. If you don't do this, I'll cut you out of my will. If you do this, I'll cut you out of my will. If you do this, well, you'll be very wealthy when I die. It's kind of pathetic, isn't it? But it's going on all the time. As an astrologer, I've done a good few cases involving the complete Mishigasan madness of wills and trusts, and it's almost always a drama. Not always. Some people are very good at estate planning, and they don't want a drama. It's why all these musical artists are selling their stuff to Universal Music Group, is they don't want a fight over their artistic property. So they just convert it to money, and then they deal with the money. It's much simpler than dealing with like the entire Bob Dylan catalog with, 10 different copyright holders and all this stuff. So it is possible to do estate planning in a calm, conscientious way. And by the way, I would suggest with all this activity going on that you do it in a calm and conscientious way and that you, you bring real wisdom to it. One discussion I'm very happy to see happening is a general questioning of all of this like constant nonstop use and abuse of alcohol. Abuse got a guy in the guise of, oh, this is just, normally social, four martinis, what's the big deal? Well, that's like half a bottle of gin. It's not a big deal unless you think half a bottle of gin is a big deal. That's in the mix. That's coming in from somewhere extrinsic to your prior, to some prior reality. And the question is, if there is an influence of alcohol, the question is, when and where did it enter? There is a very good chance you'll be able to put a pin in the map on the when and the where that it entered. And you just want to keep your fingers on the pulse of this issue. Now, let's do two more houses. I mentioned Pluto in the ninth in Aquarius. when you play this a second time, make a little note of the timestamp and then jot down some of those theories. The opposite of that is going. It's about to be Jupiter in Leo in the third. The beauty, if the ninth is about publishing, the third is about writing and thinking. In the most basic sense, you know, you write a book in a room, with a table, and a typewriter or something, quill pen. But the ninth is like, that thing goes out to the whole world. They're unrelated except for the fact that the book goes from one house to the next, then it goes out to the world. The third place is how you think, what you think, why you think it, the style in which you think it, and the actual content of that thought. You're about to have Jupiter here. Now, this does not start till the second half of the year. This is absolutely astonishing in terms of how can you make astrology be any better? It's not easy. It's pretty good. Jupiter shows up in your third house and makes a conjunction to this thing called, and I can't tell you exactly where I did my best writing. I'm still too close to inner light to know where I did my best writing on the Jupiter conjunction to Vulcanus, but check the Leo reading for that. There's no doubt going to be a very good explication of this. And I may have written about it in your sign because you're a Gemini and so affiliated with language, matters of language. Well, you've got something to say. This is me beating around the bush here. Jupiter conjunct Vulcanus in Leo opposite Pluto says you've got something to say. And this is not the, oh, I think I'll write a book someday. Oh, I think I'll write a memoir someday. And what exactly have you done? I mean, I'm not disparaging anyone's experience of life. I'm saying that when you write a book, you are creating a work of art and B, a document of something. And I don't know what your work of art is, and I don't know what your document of something is, but I can tell you that they're there. How do I know? Well, I started reading a horoscope in 1995, and I kind of pursued it to the absolute ultimate logical outcome, and that's what your chart says. There is substance, and the ideas are valuable. And to do them, you're going to need to kind of, I suggest you not spread the energy thin by, for example, blogging or substacking about that thing, or talking about it, or trying to sell it in advance. Focus on the ideas themselves. Focus on the writing. Get warmed up. You got a little leeway. Start getting warmed up around March 10th, when Jupiter goes direct. And then between March 10th and June 30th, Jupiter is going to clear out through those last degrees of Cancer. Very good time for financial planning. And then Jupiter on June 30 will enter Leo and start doing very big things. So it is safe and advisable and productive and practical to work in quiet. Not easy in the world, but try to isolate yourself at least for a couple of hours a day and let it flow. You may know exactly what the fuck I'm talking about. If this is not the, oh, I think I'll write a memoir someday kind of writing, which it's not for you. But I always hear that, like, you know, I have to write my book. Now, I'm not making fun of people for that. I'm making fun of what they think has to, why they think they have to do that. And it's so early 20th century anyway. No, I'm saying that for you, it is going to feel like you are fucking on fire. It's not some kind of a casual, whimsical kind of thing. There's likely to be a sense of urgent necessity infused with a kind of illumination. Leo is illuminated. It is the sign of the sun. It is illuminated by daylight. And this contact point of Jupiter, Vulcanus, Pluto also includes Neptune, it includes Uranus, it includes Trans-Pluto, it's going to include Apollon and Scorpio, it's going to include, I forget which sign, this asteroid I love. I'm not doing a lot of asteroid work in this reading, but there's an asteroid involved. Sour. Calculated trajectory. Plotting a course. All lights up in July. Don't rush it, sister. Don't rush it, bro. One last thing. Let's talk Chiron in Taurus. So the embodiment crisis is a crisis of sanity, not downward facing dog. It's a crisis of sanity. It's a crisis of detachment from reality. Chiron in Taurus, to me, seems like it is going to be a very rapid onset of sanity coming with, holy shit, what have I been doing? And for you, this is in the 12th place, which is already cryptic and mysterious, but very much a part of who you are. And that's the Taurus influence. You are going to be taken deeply inward, introspective, inward seeking, inward looking, with a very strong context of past history. That's Taurus, always has a very strong context of past history. It's not often said to be that way, but I think that that it is, particularly certain forms of social history. And will bring you back to yourself in a way that you may never have experienced. Also, if you're born between 1977 and about 1983, you're having your Chiron return. This is going to be very helpful and influential transit in your life, and you get to have it. But we all will get a little bit of an honorary Chiron return type of aspect when Chiron reaches its discovery position, which will do in 2027 in your 12th house. So this is really about a discovery. You're going to discover something about yourself. And all astrology is like this, but you're don't tell any of the other signs I said this. But Gemini, all this complete and utter weirdness going on in the sky, on the planet right now, and all of this, like, you know, people being driven to extremes by not only overexposure to digital conditions, but not having any clue that that's what their problem is or the whole world's problem. And these dipsticks in the District of Columbia, somebody needs to tell them, you're just having a bad case of digititis. In the midst of this whole world, you've got the chart. You've got the chart. I haven't even mentioned yet. I wrote about some of them, but you've got the chart. You've got the place where it's happening. And, you know, remember that you're going to be a little bit of a different person. You're going to feel like a different person. You may get your thing where you're feeling a little kinky. That's Uranus in your sign, and Taurus taking to transit from Chiron will, you know, amplify sexual consciousness. Pluto in the ninth will do so as well. Pluto in the ninth will teach you, if you haven't figured it out, that sexual consciousness is the most important foundational level of spirituality. And not for nothing, there's a reason why all the great religions of the world, all of them except really Hinduism, in the deep inward conclave of Tantra, all deny sex. Hinduism is the best one because you have Lord Krishna, who's in love with Radharani, and she's a gopi. She's this ordinary cowgirl. And Krishna loved his gopis, and everyone knows that Krishna loved his gopis, and then he chose Radharani as his consort. So Hinduism gets it. And you might want to check out some of those texts, because you're going to get it too. You're going to realize this is the inherently most organic level of spirituality is connecting with one's sexual truth and sexual reality, and that's you know, everywhere you've been, everywhere you are, everything you want, and everywhere you're gonna go. So this wraps up the 23rd the 23rd project, the Inner Light, Inner Peace series. You are the 11th of recording, and I'm gonna do Taurus tomorrow. I am doing Taurus tonight. I want to be fresh, and I thank you for your trust and tuning in and checking out these ideas. Any questions, get a hold of me. Alrighty, signing off from the Harshaw House, 8:08 p.m. That, by the way, is the music of Intrastellar included. 10 hours of it. Lots of love. And an interestingly structured composition. All right. Bye for now.